Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also come to see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight, my special guest is Amber Lanier Nagel. She's a Georgia girl through and through. In 2006, after working for 18 years as an engineer, she reinvented herself as a freelance writer specializing in nonfiction stories. Her work has appeared in Grit, Mother Earth News, Georgia Magazine, Atlanta Life, Points North, Chatter, Get Out Chattanooga, and many other magazines and newspapers. For 11 years, she penned a monthly newspaper column focusing on memories, relationships, and unique observations from her lifetime in Georgia. In 2012, she published a selection of these articles in an ebook titled Southern Exposure, A Few Random Rambling Retrospective Pieces of My Life. She's the brainchild behind Project Keepsake, which is a collection of stories told in the first person by ordinary people about their treasured keepsakes and mementos, and she conducts writing about keepsakes workshops in Georgia and Tennessee to help aspiring writers find their voice and craft through their own keepsake stories. She's a graduate of Georgia Institute of Technology and Mercer University, and she's an active member of the Georgia Writers Association and the Chattanooga Writers Guild. So once again, I'm going to ask you, Amber, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you for having me tonight.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. I'm always interested in people that reinvent themselves. Now, what got you on the track to leaving behind another profession and getting into writing?
Well, it's a long story, and I'll give you the condensed version. I had always loved to read as a child. You know, I loved books. I loved the way they smelled. I read them all the time. And then at some point, the love of reading kind of evolved into a love of writing. And I would write really short pieces, or I might do a little family research, or my grandmother might tell me a story, and I would write it down, you know, thinking that I need to preserve this story. She's old, you know, I need to preserve this. So I was always kind of doing a little writing, and yes, I became an engineer, and I worked for years as an engineer. But we moved up to Northwest Georgia sometime around 1999, and after we were here for 2 or 3 years, the plant that I was working at closed, and it was kind of a rural area that didn't have a lot of job opportunities. And there were a few, though, and as I was kind of going around the region looking for work and giving my resume to different companies, I found myself with a lot of time on my hands, and I did start writing about that time just because I kind of needed some type of release, some type of outlet, and I started writing more of the family stories. I told the story about how when I was a little girl, we had chickens. And at some point, you know, my mom killed one of my favorite roosters when I was at school. And I didn't know it for several days. I know it's a horrible story. It's a horrible story. But those were the types of stories that I was writing. Things from my memory, things from my childhood, things about relationships I had with cousins or aunts or uncles. And I sent a couple of them to the editor of the small newspaper that was not very far from our house, and he loved them and started putting them on the op-ed page. of the little newspaper, and people really responded to them. They asked me to write a column, and I did that for years. And it that's probably the one single thing that happened in my life that really made me want to write even more, because I had an audience. Once a month, I would sit down and collect my thoughts and try to figure out what am I going to write about. It gave me structure. I developed a writing voice, and I did that for years. And then the rest of it just kind of, you know, fell out of that. I did go back to work as an engineer and worked there for years until that plant decided it would close. And then at that point, I started saying, you know, I really love to write, and I think I'm getting pretty good at it. I wonder if, you know, maybe there's a market for writing for magazines. So I took an online class for about $75, and it gave me all the nuts and bolts that I needed to become a freelance writer. And I've been a freelance writer ever since.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So that's how it all happened.
That's an amazing story. I love hearing stories like that. So I talked to you a little bit before we went on air, but your book, Project Keepsake, which is out now, would you tell writers how you came to, I mean, the readers, I'm sorry, the listeners, I'm reading and the writing tonight. Would you tell the listeners how you came to embark on that project?
Sure. So again, you know, I learned how to write by the act of actually sitting down once a month and writing a story. And not everybody has that luxury of, you know, having something that they have to do once a month, you know, because everybody's lives are so busy now. They push it, you know, off to the side. I'll do this later. I'll write about this later. And then it never happens. So I wanted to help others, because I'm one of these people, once I learn how to do something, I'm just all about sharing how to do it, especially something like writing, because so many people would love to sit down and write something. They all mm-hmm. have personal experiences that they would love to write down. They just don't know how to go about doing it. So I started doing workshop facilitation. Some of them were free, and then some of them were for a fee. But I did start doing a lot of workshops about 4 or 5 years ago. And some of them would be how to, you know, get into the freelance writing market. And then, of course, some would just be how to write stories down. You know, and we would just go step by step, but it never failed. Somebody would come to one of those workshops and they would say, I want to write so bad. I just want to write so bad, but I don't have anything to write about. I'm always having writer's block. And that's just something that's kind of foreign to me, because I think that I don't have enough time before I die to write everything down. So I would always ask these people questions, and I would say, let me ask you something. You know, what's on the mantle at your house? What do you keep on the shelves next to your bed? Do you have a shoebox in your closet that's got something that you keep? And they would always have something, almost always. I would be able to find something, and then they would just start talking about it. And I'd say, well, there's your story. Tell me the story about this thing that you keep. And I would go to people's houses, and I would pick things up in their houses, and I'd say, where did this come from? And they would just start telling beautiful stories to me. And I would say, you know, you really should write that down. So that's kind of how the whole project came to be. I used it as a writing prompt. I would go about telling people how to shape a story about their keepsake. And, of course, the story is almost never about the keepsakes. It's about some memory that keepsake holds for that person. Like every time you walk by a certain vase in your house, you think about somebody or where it came from or why you've kept it for so long. But that's kind of how the whole project came to be, is I started trying to get people to write these stories down. And then, you know, a lot of times after they would write one, they would be so excited they would want to share it with me. And after a while, I started thinking, you know, these are all so interesting. All the keepsakes are so different. But at the same time, everybody's life experience is so similar. It's kind of like you said in your intro, we're really all the same. The keepsakes are different. The stories might be a little bit different. But each of these keepsake stories just really hits home the fact that we're all cut from the same cloth. We're all going through the same journey. We all miss people that we've lost. And so that's kind of where Project Keepsake is. I started collecting stories, and after I collected about 55, we put them in a book, and my agent, Jeannie, found a publisher. I've been promoting.
Oh, that's great. How's the book doing?
It's doing pretty good. You know, it was a little bit slow at the beginning, you know, and I think that was because I was a brand new author and really didn't know how to go about getting my foot in the door of some of the places like speaking engagements and things. But after a couple months, you know, I just got the hang of it and just started getting out there. So it's going pretty good.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, can you tell us some of the stories that are in the book, some of the keepsakes?
Sure. I'll mention some of the keepsakes first because there's such a variety of keepsakes, and then I'll come back and I'll just kind of mention the significance of a few of them. But we've got hats, we've got a fiddle, a guitar, we have a Red Cross pin, we have a couple of rings in the collection, a couple pieces of furniture. Like I wrote about an old Singer sewing machine, and another friend of mine, Julie Moss, she wrote about her dad's dresser. There's a vase, that Civil War era vase. There's a milking stool that a friend of mine, Jesse Vaughn, he keeps in his law office in Calhoun, Georgia. I think it belonged to his great-grandmother. She used to milk cows with this stool, and he keeps it in his office to remember where he came from. There's pie plate, quilts, pocket watch, carnival glass. A lady wrote about a book. Another person wrote about a plastic spoon, pocket knife, aprons, pastry brushes, fishing lures, fishing reels. I mean, as you say, there's just people keep all sorts of things. And some of the things are really unusual. People will say sometimes, well, I've got something, but you wouldn't believe it if you told me. And at this point, I say, oh, I'll believe you because I know people just keep all sorts of things. But one of the guys in the collection, he wrote about a brick. And he was my friend Wayne Minshew. He passed away a few months ago, but he wrote about a brick. And I'll tell you that story quickly. He was a baseball player. He had played for the University of Georgia and then went to the minor leagues for a little while. But when he was at the University of Georgia, he considered that his glory days. He and the other baseball players, I think, pretty much ran the campus, and they were studs. And anyway, at some point a few years ago, he got a box in the mail, and he opened the box. He wasn't expecting it, and there was this brick, and it had a note from one of the other players that had played baseball with him in the 50s at the University of Georgia. And it said, I was on campus today, and they had imploded the old field house where we lived when we were baseball players, and I picked a few of these up for you. So it just was a reminder of that time when he played baseball. And, of course, Wayne went on. I think he worked with the Atlanta Braves for a little while as their marketing and PR guy. So he kind of had a whole lifetime full of baseball, but that brick had a really special meaning to him because, you know, it just brought all of these memories back from when he was in college playing ball.
Sure.
I had a friend, now this story is not in the collection. Project Keepsake also has its own website, projectkeepsake.com, and there's a blog on that website, and a lot of times people send me stories now, and I'll actually post them on the blog. So one of my friends who's a writer in Chattanooga, Cheryl Snow, she had sent a keepsake story to me a few months ago, and it's about her mother's hair. She keeps her mom's hair like in a plastic bag. And I know everybody's going, that's just the weirdest thing. But when you learn the story, you know, it's a story about her mother having cancer, her mother going through treatment, her mother's beautiful hair, and the day that they decided that they needed to just go ahead and cut it off because it was falling out. And she put it in this plastic bag, and that was years ago. But, you know, when she looks at it, she doesn't see anything weird. She just, it just, is a reminder of a very painful, tragic time, but it's also a reminder of how her mother had this just beautiful head of hair and how her mother prided herself on how she looked. But it's just a beautiful story. So a keepsake can be almost anything. People keep really, really interesting things because they hold memories. So do you have a keepsake, David?
I have a lot of keepsakes, actually. And you were talking about the hair. I actually have a lock of hair that belonged to my sister, which was precious to me. She had died of cancer. So, she was very fond of pigs. And when her friends found out about that, she ended up getting a collection of pigs that turned into a house full of pigs. Everything you could imagine.
Wow.
Ceramics, stuffed pigs, porcelain pigs. You name it, and I have a few of those here too. But then I'm a collector, and I collect a lot of things that just bring beauty into my life, and I wouldn't call those keepsakes per se. But you know, when you talked about the woman with her mother's hair, that really resonated for me. How about yourself? What are some of your keepsakes?
I have a house full of keepsakes. And sometimes I don't even realize that an item is a keepsake. But, okay, I'm in my office right now, and I'm looking at the wall. We had our first frost this week in Georgia, and so I had to bring in a lot of the plants that were on my front porch. And one of the plants that I brought in is in a hideous pink plastic bucket. And if someone came to my house, they would wonder, what in the world? I mean, you know, it's so out of place. But let me tell you why I keep this bucket. My mother actually gave me this bucket a couple of years ago, but it was my Easter. We didn't have Easter baskets when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s. For some reason, me and my brother and sister, we had Easter buckets. I had one. I think my sister's was orange. I think my brother had a blue one. I don't know. But anyway, Mom had kept them in the attic for years. And when she was cleaning some things out a couple of years ago, she found them. And she gave me a plant in this old plastic Easter bucket. And like I said, it's so hideous. But I love it so much. It just reminds me of all the Easters that we used to go down to South Georgia and spend at my grandmother's house. You know, in South Georgia, we would have a big Easter egg hunt, and all the cousins would come. And the older children would hide the eggs out in the woods, and we would just go out and hunt them. And then there was just nothing better than sitting on the back of a truck on the tailgate with these hard-boiled eggs that you had just found in the woods and in a really cold Coke, you know, and someone would bring shakers of salt and pepper. We would sit there for an hour and just laugh and talk and eat these eggs. And those are the memories that are associated with this pink Easter bucket that I have in my office right now. But in the book itself, the two stories that I wrote for the collection that was published, one is about a Singer sewing machine that belonged to my grandmother Lanier, my paternal grandmother. And it was, I think that it's a 1909 Singer sewing machine. It's one of those foot treadle ones where you have to pump it with your foot to actually make the needle go up and down.
Right.
When she passed away, it's more of an heirloom, but an heirloom in my book is a keepsake. And because it's something that I treasure, and it's something that you couldn't give me, you know, $1 million for. But,
absolutely.
Yeah. So I wrote about that, and I wrote about my memories of my grandmother, because when I see the sewing machine, I think about how hard her life was, because it was not an easy thing. I've tried to sew on that sewing machine before. It's not easy. And she made quilts, and she made clothing. She made curtains. She made everything that they needed because they didn't have a lot of disposable income. My grandfather was a farmer, so they didn't do very well in the Great Depression. And when I see that sewing machine, I think about how tough she was and how some of that blood still pumps in me. So that's one of the stories I wrote for the book. It's about a sewing machine. And then the other one is the first story in the collection, and it's called Herman's Brown Buckeyes. And here again, it's a little different because, you know, people will say, well, a buckeye doesn't sound like much of a keepsake. It, again, it's more like a fact that I started collecting buckeyes as a result of the fact that when I was a young girl, my father would always, he would go out into the woods. He was an avid hunter. He loved the outdoors. He fished. He just loved being outside. And sometimes when he would come back from the woods, he would hand me a buckeye and he would say, keep this in your pocket. It'll bring you good luck. Are you familiar with a buckeye? A lot of people that are
outside. No, I'm not.
Yeah, it's like a little round, brown, nut-looking thing. It's really shiny. It's really pretty. Anyway, they fall off of trees. And it's kind of folklore. It's like, you know, if you find one, it'll bring you good luck. Kind of like a rabbit's foot, you know, people will say, well, that will bring you good luck. Nobody really thinks it's going to bring anybody good luck, but it's just something that people have said for generations. And so my father would say it to me because I'm sure that his dad probably said it to him. But at some point, you know, like I had lots because he would give them to me all the time, and I would have them all over the house. Like I would open a drawer. Well, there would be a buckeye, you know, where I would be driving to work and I'd open the console of my car. Well, there's a buckeye. So I had them stashed in all different places. But at the point when my father passed away, it was very sudden. No one had expected that he was going to pass away, and he died. And when my mother and my brother and my sister and I went to the funeral home to actually, you know, make sure that he looked okay for the visitation, he was wearing a flannel shirt, and there was nothing in the pocket, which was odd because he was a smoker. He always had things in his pockets. And I thought, you know, I'm going to go home tonight. I'm going to find a buckeye, and I'm going to put it in his pocket. So I went home that night. This was the night before his funeral, and I couldn't find a buckeye. And I have no idea why I couldn't find a buckeye. I guess because I was just so emotionally a wreck. But I couldn't find a buckeye, and I was really upset about it. And I called my mom and told her that I really wanted to put a buckeye in my father's pocket, but I couldn't find one. And she just kind of said, oh, don't worry about it. You know, it's nothing. It's really nothing. Don't worry about it. But the next day at the funeral, I was a little upset about it because I couldn't find anything to put in his pocket that was special. And one of my mother's really, really close friends came up to me at the funeral home and put a buckeye in my hand, and she smiled, and she said, you know, my daddy used to give these to me, too, and used to say the same thing to me. So I had the buckeye.
Hey.
Yeah, I took it. I put it in my dad's pocket, and we buried him with that buckeye in his pocket. And it's one of those things. That story, a lot of times when I do book fairs or book festivals or speaking engagements, I'll take a bowl full of these buckeyes, and I'll tell that story, and so many people can relate to that story. Here again, I think it's kind of a regional thing, so it may not be something that people up in the Northeast might really understand, but you know, Southern and Midwest area, a lot of people know, you know, have had a family member at some point give them a buckeye and tell them it would bring them good luck. So I get a lot of people, I give buckeyes out when I'm at book fairs and things, and just, it's just like a happy thing for me now that I collect them. But that's, it's kind of a keepsake. They're keepsakes to me now because I have so many, and again, it's kind of like growing up in my childhood. I keep them everywhere, so I just stumble upon them like all the time, and I like it because every time I find one, I think of my father.
That's a nice memory, very poignant tale. I'm curious, do men and women keep different types of keepsakes?
Yes, they do. And it's something that I had never really considered before I started collecting the stories. But I've seen a trend. I've seen that women tend to keep things that are like cooking related or sewing related. And I'll give you some examples. Like my friend Mitzi wrote about a cake pan. She called it Nanny's Magic Cake Pan. So she kept a cake pan after her grandmother passed away. She tells this beautiful story about how when they went to clean the house out, she marched into her grandmother's house with one thing on her mind. She was going to go to the kitchen. All she wanted was this little dented aluminum cake pan. And she was actually surprised when she opened the cabinet and saw that no one had already gotten it, because it was like her grandmother's thing was to make a cake for each of the grandchildren for their birthdays. So rolling pins and aprons and biscuit bowls and those kinds of things, a lot of women keep things that are cooking related. A lot of women keep things that are sewing related, like pin cushions. My friend Sharon Huey, that lives in Louisiana, she wrote about some silver scissors that she actually got when her grandmother passed away. I think her grandmother passed them to her mother, and then her mother passed them to Sharon. But they still had like a piece of garment tied to the scissors themselves. It was the last garment that was made. Of course, I wrote about the sewing machine. And as far as men go, men keep things like fishing lures and guns and hats and knives and fishing reels, even trucks. And I was thinking about that earlier today. My brother used to drive my Papa Lanier's truck. When my Papa Lanier passed away, my dad got the truck. And then at some point, my brother started driving it. He drove it for years. And he drove it because it was a truck, but it was a cool truck. It belonged to our grandfather. And so in a way, it was kind of a keepsake. We were talking about it not too long ago and wondering, he doesn't have it anymore. At some point, he had to get rid of it. He had too many vehicles, I think. And we were talking about the exact color it was and exactly what year it was. And we wished that we knew where it was so we could go find it again. So, men and women keep different things. But here again, the keepsakes are different. But the reason we keep things to hold those memories, bring them back to life, are really the same. People, will tell you the story, but then when you say, well, why do you keep it? It's usually because it reminds me of this person, or it reminds me of the time that I did this. They just hold those memories and they help us not forget something. It's always there for us to see and always there for us to pull back into the present and think about. Sometimes it's happy, sometimes it's sad, but still it's a way for us to remember things, is to hold on to these keepsakes.
Well, that brings up another question I had, and that was how people tend, when they share their stories, if there's much emotion connected to them.
There's a few stories in the collection that are very emotional. Here again, some of the stories are sad. They're not all sad, but a lot of times a memory can be really powerful and really sad. It's a way sometimes, and I've had a lot of the people that wrote keepsake stories tell me this, that it was almost like therapy when they wrote the story and actually got out on paper, and they would include their feelings, they would include their thoughts in their stories, that it was therapeutic. It was like a way that they healed. So some people were still suffering from some memory, and just the simple act of writing it down on paper and thinking about it and kind of coming to terms with it actually helped them through something. And I can kind of relate to that, because I know when I wrote the story about the Buckeyes, it was very hard to get it on paper. But then after I got it on paper, it kind of turned something that was a little sad for me into something kind of happy, something I think that my father would be proud of. There's a lot of emotions in some of these stories.
How do you encourage people to go about writing their own keepsake stories?
Okay, The last chapter in the book, Project Keepsake, is actually a chapter to help people who are not real familiar with the writing process. It kind of helps them a little bit with it. The first thing, of course, is you've got to, you know, if you're like me, you have several different keepsakes in your home. You have to kind of identify one thing that you really want to concentrate on. And I always tell the person to go to that room, or if it's small, bring it into the office or the space where you're going to actually do the writing. But actually have it like in your presence. And then at that point, I kind of do like a little brainstorming exercise. I tell people to answer a long line of questions. You know, for the next 10 or 15 minutes, I just want you to tell me everything that you can about this keepsake. I want to know what it is, where it came from, how long you've had it. I want you to describe what it looks like to me. I want you to describe what it smells like if it has a smell. I want you to tell me what it sounds like if it makes a sound. And I know people that are listening are probably going, well, what kind of keepsake would make a sound? A woman actually wrote a story about a music box, and it's a beautiful story. She has also passed away, but she wrote a story of a music box that she had when she was a child, and she actually talked about the tune that it played. So that would be an example of what something sounded like. What does it feel like? Does it have a texture? Is it rough? Is it smooth? Okay, and then, of course, the tough questions, like, why is it special? Why is it significant to you? What or whom does it remind you of? And why does it remind you of that person? Or why does it remind you of a particular time? Why do you keep it? Where do you keep it? Are there any stories about it or related to the keepsake? And if there are, tell me the story. Tell me the story of how you came to have ownership of it. You know, those types of questions. Does it have any monetary value? And if so, roughly how much? And a lot of times that's not really interesting to the story, but it's kind of interesting to the reader. And I'll give another example. My friend Nancy Ratcliffe, that lives in Northwest Georgia here, she wrote about some carnival glass that she inherited, and she thought it was the most hideous carnival glass that she had ever seen. It was like kind of a maroon color, and It just really didn't mean very much to her. But she kept it, and she always thought to herself, like, at some point I'm going to have like a little shelf or something, some special place in my house so that I can display this glass, because it didn't match anything in her house. And somebody, after she built the house, her and her husband moved into a different house. She had a spot, and she put the carnival glass in this little nook. I think it was in her bathroom. And a friend came over and picked it up and said, this is actually very valuable, and actually told her, you know, it was very valuable. So it's a great story. She talks about her grandmother and the fact that she, you know, was in the rolling store. Well, she wasn't in the rolling store, but the rolling store would come to the house, and she would have to save money for weeks to actually, you know, be able to afford something like that during the Depression. But anyway, so here again, that's what makes that story kind of interesting, is at the end of the story, she realized that something that she had in a cardboard box for years and, you know, was actually something that was very valuable.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's interesting. I had some carnival glass of my own, and I gave it away. Maybe I should have hung on. But, you know, as you were talking, it made me think about some other things that I have in the house that I treasure, you know, especially heirloom-type pieces and the memories connected to them. And I'm sure that's the case for a lot of people, that they may have inherited pieces of furniture that stir up particular memories about a time at Grandpa's house, and memories connected. I have a lot of memories connected to a Lincoln rocker that sits in my living room, which is my favorite chair. And it takes me back in so many different directions, connected to my grandparents from whom I inherited it. So, you know, I think it's wonderful that you're encouraging aspiring writers to find a way to find their own voice and craft their own keepsake stories. What suggestions would you make to somebody that has been thinking about writing, that has never put a pen to paper? What kinds of things would you say to them?
Well, and these are usually the people that come up to me at the end of the workshop, you know, and actually want to talk a little bit more. They're a little embarrassed to ask questions in front of other people because they assume that everybody can write. They're the only ones there that have never written before, and that's usually not the case. One of my favorite tips that I give to people that are just starting to write is don't set your goal at, I'm going to write a book. I like shorts. I like short stories. I like, little projects that you can actually start on Monday and maybe have something by the weekend, you know, something mm-hmm. very short. So start with something very short, like a memory, you know. For example, my father used to take me to various ponds and lakes and rivers, and we would fish together. And, so that might would be one project. I might would actually talk about a particular fishing trip that he and I, you know, went on together, or it may just be several things of him teaching me how to fish, or him teaching me how to shoot pool. You know, just pick something kind of small, not too broad, and actually write a small story based on that one memory or that one thing, and set your goal. Say, for example, I'm going to write this. I'm going to start it on Monday. I'm going to try to sit down and write as much as I can, like in one day, and then maybe Tuesday, Wednesday, kind of do some editing. Thursday, Friday, don't even look at it, put it away. And on Saturday, pick it up, maybe look at it one more time and edit it one more time. And by Sunday, you should have something that's actually very nice, something that you would share and let other people read. I also have other little tips that I give in my workshops that help people who are just starting to write. For example, when they do write something short, here again, I'm kind of concentrating on short projects, go back through it and underline all the verbs, all of the verbs, underline them, and stop and think about each verb and think to yourself, how can I make it a stronger verb? And it's kind of like a common thing that a lot of writers know to do, but a person that has never really written before doesn't understand how to actually select a verb that might be a little stronger. I think that the example that I use in the last chapter of Project Keepsake is kind of a common example. It's, you know, a car is actually driving down a hill or driving through a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I've got my book right here. I'm going to look at it real quick. You actually can have, like, many, many other verbs that are stronger. You can actually say, you know, the car tore out down the road. It squealed down the road. It putted down the road. You know, and so I always tell them to play with the verbs. That I feel like that makes writing more interesting. Another thing that I tell them to do is be a little descriptive, but not too descriptive. Like, don't just say, you know, that Susan got in the car. Tell me what kind of car Susan got in, because sometimes it gives a visual image to the reader. So these are some really easy things that anybody can do. A lot of times people will say that they walked into a kitchen. Well, that doesn't tell people a lot of things, but if you said, you know, that you walked into the kitchen and, you know, you actually smelled biscuits baking in an oven, something like that. It actually helps the reader visualize everything. They might even be able to smell those biscuits. So mm-hmm. little tips like that will actually help. And then with keepsake stories, another thing that I often tell people is after you shape your story and you get it almost done, it's like 95% there, I always look at the way I begin it and I try to come up with a better way to start the story. I always try to start a keepsake story with an action. So, for example, in the keepsake story I wrote about the Buckeyes, which are the reminders of my father, I started the story where he's actually coming in from the woods and he falls down in a big black leather recliner and empties his pockets on the side table and he tosses a Buckeye over and I catch it in my hand. So that's a little bit of an action. It kind of draws the reader in a little bit because there's something going on right at the beginning. Because a lot of new writers just want to start at the very beginning and say, you know, I keep Buckeyes and I have special Buckeyes because they were special to, you know, to my father and he always gave me Buckeyes. And that's great, but there's actually more compelling ways to start the story. And so I always tell people, look at the story after you get it 95% done and look at the things where there's action or something of interest or even some strong dialogue and start there and then come back to some of the detail. And if you can do all those things, you're going to have such a good keepsake story. It's just going to be beautiful and everybody's going to love it and you're going to be proud.
Oh, that's great advice. That's wonderful. Tell me, do you have another volume of keepsake stories coming up?
Well, I haven't decided whether or not I'm going to put a second volume together because, like I said, I really enjoyed putting the stories up on the blog of projectkeepsake.com. That's a really good way for me to be able to share other people's stories and people can send them to me. The book itself, I love the book. A lot of people have told me how much the book has meant to them. And part of me does want to do it, but like it was an awful lot of work, and I don't know if I can really get to it right now. But maybe next year, you know, maybe next year there'll be a little bit more time in my schedule, and maybe I can get to a second volume. But here again, I'm still collecting the stories, and I'm still putting them up on the blog.
Yeah. Now, tell the listeners again where they can find you on the net and also where they can get a hold of your book, Project Keepsake.
Okay. I am on the net. I have a Facebook page that's on Facebook. It's Project Keepsake. Also, I'm myself on Facebook and they connect to me if they want to. I'm at Amber Lanier Nagel. There's a website, projectkeepsake.com. That's where the blog is that has a lot of the other stories and the excerpts of some of the stories that are actually in the book, the collection that was published. They can contact me through that website very easily. They can read some of the sample stories. And I believe that there's even a section of, you know, if you want to start trying to write a story, you can actually pull down some instructions there of, you know, some tips. Some of the tips that we talked about, I think, are actually posted there. So that's how
they
can actually contact me. Yeah. If they want a copy of the book, it's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. It's both in ebook format and the paperback. I recommend the paperback because, I love Kindle, and I actually have Kindle books myself, but I also still do real books. The thing is after you read it, a lot of people have told me this, that one particular story in the collection may remind them of something and they want to pass the book on to a friend or a relative that they know would enjoy that story. So that's why I say a lot of times for this book, the paperback book is actually, you know, something that you can share with somebody else.
Right.
You can also go to Project Keepsake. It's available on my personal website, projectkeepsake.com. The publisher was Native Ink Publishing. You can get it from their website. So there's a lot of different ways. If you just Google Project Keepsake, it should be the first five or six things that come up would probably show you different places where it's available. And, of course, you know, I do lots of speaking engagements, and I'm still at libraries sometimes and that kind of thing. And so if they see me out in public and they want to sign a copy, I'd be more than happy to sign a copy and you know, send it to them.
Wonderful. Well, tell me a little bit about Southern Exposure.
Okay, well, that goes back to when I started writing, you know, years ago for that newspaper, and I was writing the monthly column, you know, and some of the stories were just about memories and that sort of thing. So they were just sitting in my computer, and some of them were really good, and I was proud of them. But then it's kind of like once they get published in the newspaper, they just kind of stayed in my computer, and they were going to die there. And about the time when people started publishing things in ebook format, I was curious, and I kind of wanted to know how to do that. I wanted to learn the process of creating an ebook. So I took lots of my favorite stories from that time where I had the newspaper column, and I pulled them together. I wrote an introduction, and I did it kind of as a way for me to learn the process of creating an ebook. But it actually turned out really good, and I included stories in there about, learning how to make my grandmother's thin, crispy cornbread. She would actually make it in the bottom of a skillet, so it looked kind of like a pancake. It wasn't thick like a lot of people eat thick cornbread. Her cornbread was thin. So I learned how to do that, and I wrote a story about that. It's in there. I wrote a story about my father teaching my brother and sister and I how to build a kite with newspaper and sticks and glue and some twine. So that story's in there. There's a story. I was talking about a story just yesterday, in fact, with a friend. I learned how to divine several years ago. I don't know if your listeners would know that term or not, but it's you can actually take a coat hanger and you can kind of bend it so that it's at a right angle. And you can hold it in your hand very loosely. And if you, like, walk across your lawn and say you have a cable line that's cutting across your front yard, it will start to move when you start to cross that location if you're holding that rod just right. But the story is, and here again, I have an engineering background, and one of my coworkers and I, we had to actually map out where some pipes were under our building one time, and we had asked the civil engineering unit to come over with some maps and help us know where these pipes were under the building. We were going to do some construction. And they came over, and they had coat hangers. And we watched them for about 30 minutes walk all around the building with these coat hangers in their hand, and we thought that they were trying to pull a joke on us. And we didn't believe that they were actually doing things, but the coat hanger would start to move in their hand, and they would take a can of spray paint and they would mark it. And after about 30 minutes, I walked over to them and I said, "Are you guys pulling my leg, or can you really tell where the pipes are and the underground utilities and everything are with these metal rods?" And the guy says, "I'll show you how to do it." And he showed me how to do it, and I couldn't believe it. I went home that night, and I was going through my own yard, and I was showing it to my husband saying, "Look, we have a water line. It's right here." And then I would walk some more, and it's like, "Here's where the cable comes into the house." I was so excited because I learned how to do that. But that story's in Southern Exposure. And, of course, the chicken story that everybody laughs about, how I accidentally ate my pet chicken. My mom, of course, had to kill an extra rooster when I was at school one day, and she knew that it would just crush me, so she didn't tell me. And when I got home that afternoon, I said, "Well, where's Rusty?" And she said, "Oh, all the chickens got out. Then, some of them have already come home, but he'll come home later." And he didn't, and for two or three days he never came home, and we just assumed that he died. And I didn't ask any questions. I guess I was about 8 years old. And at some point about two or three weeks later, my brother, who's 5 years older than me, got mad at me and just blurted out, "You're so stupid, you ate your pet chicken and you didn't even know it."
Oh, no.
Oh. I looked at my mom. I couldn't believe it. 8 years old, and all of a sudden my world has been destroyed because my mom has deceived me. She just looked at me and she said, "I'm so sorry, but we just had too many roosters." But yeah, I had to find peace in my heart to forgive all of my family members. But yeah, that story's in Southern Exposure too. So some of them are kind of quirky. I guess you can tell from the stories that some of them are kind of quirky, but they're all true. They're all based on things that really happened. One of the stories about playing basketball in junior high and high school, and how it just seemed like every other game somebody would bust my nose open when I would go up for a rebound. And it's just a funny story about how the coach used to tease me because I was the person that always had the bloody nose. But that's Southern Exposure. It's an ebook. It's on Kindle, and it's also in the Nook store. And it's just a book of little quirky stories that I told when I was writing that newspaper column. And I just had fun with those stories. And even to this day, those stories are beloved to me. And it's just fun. And it's a good way for people that are here again wanting to kind of get out and learn how to write and write short stories about a memory or their family members without upsetting their family members. Kind of a good guide of how you might go about that. So that's what Southern Exposure is all about.
They sound like they're filled with love. I'm just wondering how the little 8-year-old girl reconciled herself with her mother on forgiveness. I mean, forgiveness is a big thing for us to do, especially when we're kids.
It is.
You know?
It is. I know. I'm one of these people who have very vivid memories. I'm not those people who remember, like, you know, what day of the week, you know, July the 2nd, 1962 fell on, but I do have a really strong memory. And I still kind of remember that feeling, that surprise sitting at the table that day when I realized that we had actually eaten fried chicken and that it was my rooster. I kind of remember that sense, that horrible sense. But at the same time, you know, my parents were very, you know, very down-to-earth people. And, you know, if you're going to eat meat, if you're going to have chickens, if you're going to have cows, you know, if you're going to have things like that, we were realists, you know. They weren't just pets. Not all of the animals that we raised were pets.
Right.
A lot of them were. But anyway, I guess that's how I learned to forgive her for that. But it was tough, David. I'm not going to lie. I mean, it was tough. it's a hard thing. But I agree with you. I think that forgiveness is probably the hardest thing, one of the hardest things that anybody can learn to do in life. And I turned 50 this year, and I feel like I'm doing so much better at it later in my life than I was when I was in my 20s. It was very hard to forgive as a young adult, and you know, it's starting to get easier for me to forgive. You know, do you feel that way?
Absolutely. And
yeah.
Without being able to do it, though, I'm only poisoning myself. And I don't know about you, but I quite often find that the person at the top of the list I need to forgive is myself for being mad at somebody else for being human, for doing something that's very human, that's not specifically directed at me, that comes from their own stuff. And, you know, just to relate to the rooster story, my father had a pet chicken when he was a boy growing up during the Depression, and he ended up eating that too. And so you're not the only one that's eaten a pet chicken. But no,
yeah.
Don't you find that number one on the forgiveness scale is dealing with forgiving yourself?
I do kind of think that way, but I also think that we're harder on ourselves sometimes. We hold ourselves to different standards than we hold other people sometimes. I know that sometimes I'll have a very quick thought, and then I'll get so mad at myself for having that thought. It'll be, you know, unfair or uninformed. You know, and then I'll be upset with myself. And so you're right. I actually have to give myself a break sometimes and say, you know, I think a lot of it is being able to realize that I did that and feeling regret and remorse and trying to change the way I think. So I'm doing better about forgiving myself for little things like that. But it's hard. It is hard to forgive yourself for things. It's especially a thought, you know, something that pops into your mind because, you know, you can't prevent that from happening. It just does.
Right. Right. They are seemingly the small things that trip us up quite often. And, you know, I think that it's so important to remain aware of what's going on in your mind, because it's so easy to get into that trap where you are beating yourself up, and that's not a loving thing to do. And if you can't be loving towards yourself, then that robs you of your capacity to be loving towards other people too, don't you think?
I absolutely think that. I really do. I think that that's one of the keys to life.
Well, you know, life is all about coming to terms and accepting, as you did in the rooster story, accepting that everything happens for a reason, and we can judge it as good or bad, but ultimately it's all got to be for the good if we're going to remain in a positive vein and keep on track and keep moving in a forward direction. If we don't, then we keep ruminating about the past and we're not staying present and not able to enjoy the future as it unfolds.
I agree with that. I think that that's absolutely right. And I don't say this with a broad stroke, but I meet people that seem to be on autopilot every day, and they're not actually thinking about themselves and trying to better themselves and trying to respond better to situations. And I try to be so mindful, you know, without beating myself up. I just feel like we're all works in progress and that we're all here, you know, trying to do the same thing, just trying to lead really good, decent lives and help one another. And it's frustrating for me sometimes when you come into contact with people that, you know, just don't feel the same way. It's like there's no lesson to be learned for them. I don't waste my time dwelling on that, but I do think the world would be a better place if everybody was being more mindful and trying to do the right things and kind and generous and understanding and compassionate. You know, I think that there's a lot to that.
I totally agree. And, you know, I think it all comes back to the golden rule. I always maintain that if we only practice the golden rule and we're kind to other people as we'd hope they'd be kind to us, that we wouldn't need the Ten Commandments. But we've come to the end of the hour, and I really have enjoyed it. I wish you the best of luck with your book, Project Keepsake, and encourage people to go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or find you on the net. And please let me know when you have another work in progress and get back in touch with me.
Thank you so much, and I will. And I've really enjoyed the hour. It flew by.
It did. Well, best wishes to you, Amber. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we allow it to be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.